The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Meyer.
Happy Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Welcome to the show. Join in at 770-563-3770-KMED. The email bill at billmeyershow.com. You can, pardon me just a moment here. I'm trying to get the Mevo camera going for the Facebook Live, and of course, the Facebook Live, if I, you know, I swear, if the Facebook Live is not up, then there are many people who just are not able to function, and gosh, I just can't handle any more people being depressed and non-functioning, okay? We have to keep everybody in the upright and locked position. There we go. Facebook Live is going. It was just giving me a little trouble this morning, okay? Well, the reason I brought up this, hey, we had to keep everybody non-depressed and functioning and in the upright and locked position is because there was a story I was listening to this morning on this morning with Gordon Deal. I was talking about it with a boss, too, and I was just like shaking my head. It's like, it's, I don't know, is it because most of the news is being written by 12-year-olds these days that have absolutely no no historical references, no memory of any time other than right now, or maybe even just only 10 or 20 years ago. I don't know. Maybe there is something with this. But the big story, it's reported in Fortune and a bunch of other places. Millions of Americans, especially Generation X, are dealing with psychiatric disorders associated with leaded gasoline. This is a new study, and it's a journal in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. It has calculated that millions of Americans are dealing with mental illness that is caused by exposure to lead in the gasoline, tetraethyl lead, exhaust from cars. Researchers finding that those born between 1966 and 1986, that is Generation X. Now, that's the generation just right after me. I'm one of the last boomers, 1961. I actually consider myself more like a Generation Jones because I don't relate to the Woodstock crowd. You know that it's not my deal, right? But still, they consider me a baby boomer. But then right after me, Generation X were the most lead exposed as they were children during the peak of leaded gasoline's usage. Now, I remember, and now I love Generation X. I like Generation X because Generation X is kind of like, you know, the slacker generation. Hey, we don't care. They've turned into great parents. They really have. I think most of them have turned into pretty darn good parents, in some ways better than boomer parents, in my opinion, if I was going to make some judgment calls on various generations and such. But Generation X, it's not your fault. It's not because of the way you were raised. It's just because of the leaded gasoline. You know how long leaded gasoline, how long they put tetraethyl lead in gasoline? I went and looked it up because I knew it was a long time. Since the 1920s. The gasoline from the 1920s all the way through the mid to late 90s, it was finally completely phased out in the late 90s. I think it was 1995, 1996, if I recall correctly. So what's the drive here? What do you think's really in play? They're making the claim in this study that Generation X is depressed because of tetraethyl lead. That's the overall arching theme, you know, of the story. Except that I was exposed to tons of tetraethyl lead. You were exposed to tons of tetraethyl lead. If you were a silent generation, even before the boomers, you were exposed to tons of tetraethyl lead too, because, you know, back then there was no pollution controls on cars, and it was lead in the gasoline. Lead was in the gasoline. Now, I suppose you could make the case that maybe we were paying more attention to smog, but I can show you pictures of smog from L.A. in the 1940s, and the 1950s, and the 1960s, and the 1970s, but it's only been a problem for Generation X, for the most part. I don't buy it. So, you know, I'm just thinking about this, you know. Yeah, like Nirvana, yeah. It's not my fault. It's because of the tetraethyl lead. I just don't... this whole idea that we are medicalizing everything that goes wrong. So there was a lot of depression coming out of Generation X. It couldn't have anything to do with many of them being raised in the 1970s, in which it was decided by the globalists that wanted feminism that women's true role is to be a corporate cog in corporate America, and that children were to be left home and to be latchkeys or watched by somebody else. It couldn't be anything like that. No, 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 no. What drove them into the basement to listen to Kurt Cobain and get all depressed was gasoline engine car exhaust. That's it. That's what caused the ADD. It's what caused the depression. Now, I'm not saying that there's not a connection. There are connections, but they were talking about connections with tetraethyl lead and depression and problems with childhood development in the 1940s and the 1950s, the 1950s and the 60s. Why all of a sudden do we have everybody talking about tetraethyl lead? It's depression with Generation X. Generation X, you are a victim. And I'm not saying that you don't have damage. We probably all have some of this. We had leaded paint that we used to live around. We had asbestos. I remember in the schools, Berlin Milan Middle School. I'd be running down the hall, and we had the heating pipes above our heads in the 1930s building, and they were coated. They were wrapped in asbestos sheets. And what did we do? We poked them with our pens as we were running by when we'd scrawl graffiti on it, and we'd get yelled at by Principal Mitchell and all the rest of it, And we lived. We all had the same exposures, multiple generations. Now, maybe Generation X got a little bit more of it. This is what I think is the real agenda in play. When you have the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry saying, no, it's not the way that kids were raised in Generation X. It wasn't the culture. It wasn't the corrosion of the culture. It was the leaded gasoline. They got more of that in their system than everybody else. No. I think what this is all about, this is the next climate change lawsuit. This is going to be the next climate change lawsuit grift. Can't you hear the ads already coming up on late night television? Are you Generation X? Are you depressed? Get in touch with the law offices of Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. You're due compensation from big, mean oil that put tetraethyl lead in gasoline. It's not your fault. It's their fault. Call now. You know that's where it's going to go. It's going to be about lawsuits, don't you think? Tell me I'm wrong. If not, 770-5633. This is the Bill Maher Show.
The Artisan Bakery.
Hi, I'm Cassie from Clouser Drilling, and I'm on KMED.
21 minutes after 6. I just want you thinking critically about this latest story with millions of Americans, especially Gen X, dealing with psychiatric disorders associated with leaded gasoline exhaust. Except we were all exposed to leaded gasoline from the 1920s on. But they're claiming that Gen X is having the most problems with mental illness, with mental health problems because of leaded gasoline. In fact, they're talking about IQ and all the rest of it and low IQ, et cetera, et cetera. I just think that this is just, this is going to be used as the next grift with the trial lawyers. That's what I'm thinking. Jeff in Grants Pass, how are you doing this morning, Jeff? Any thoughts this morning about it? Go ahead.
No, I grew up, I was born in 69, and I grew up, when they had leaded gas and all that. But
we all grew up when, listen, Jeff, we all grew up when we had leaded gas. They've had leaded gas since the 1920s. All of us had it,
Well, I mean, and then like I said, when I called in, I go, did they ever have a huge lawsuit where, call now for your compensation for cigarettes?
Well,
I don't remember that.
No, they didn't do that because it was done at the state level. We had all of the attorney generals get involved in it, and it was billions of dollars transferred into the state of Oregon and other states as part of the tobacco settlement, which then promptly got spent on communist programs is what ended up being done with the money. That is what happened. But that's who got compensated.
We got rid of the lead in the gas, mm-hmm. you know, apparently, you know, I don't, obviously don't test it, but we still have cigarettes that kill people.
Yes, we do.
So I don't, what's the deal with that? I mean, my mother passed away from cancer, you know, from smoking and all that. And that was before they had the big warning labels on everything like that. We never got compensation. I don't remember warning labels on the gas station saying that there's lead, but I mean, they actually pulled that. We're still killing people with cigarettes all the time.
Yeah, except that I think it's pretty well known that, you know, you're doing it to yourself, I guess. And the other part about this, though, Jeff, is that, let's be honest with ourselves, there are very, very high cigarette taxes, and the state of Oregon makes bank on that. So for the people that are willing to poison themselves with the cigarettes and cigars or any of the other tobacco-like products, that you know, that's pretty good money for the state of Oregon, and they probably don't want to get rid of that racket. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, but what happens if your vehicle ran better and cleaner with lead in it? Would it be okay to put it back in it? because everybody knows that it's in there. You know, it's just because I understand that the lobbyists probably from the tobacco industry pay, you know, tons of politicians, and the petroleum companies obviously pay probably a ton of money to politicians. So I don't understand why all of a sudden there's a lawsuit and you may get money from Colin Switzer and Schnitzel for, you know, your lead in your gas, but no person ever got that I know of money from cigarette companies. And I'm,
well, I think part of it is that you volunteered to take the cigarette. You know, to get the cigarette for the most part. Now, I suppose you could make a claim to try to make that claim of secondhand smoke. You had no choice if you were in the transportation system. You were using lead, and by the way, the lead was there as an anti-knock additive to raise the octane of the you know, of the gasoline. It wasn't about I think it also protected the valve seats of some of the older cars. They had to improve. They had to change the engine design after, if I recall correctly. But, you know, they discovered that it worked and it was really cheap, and that's why they used it back then. We weren't as smart about some of the things we did. I don't think there was any evil intent in that particular case, but I don't think anyone could ever make the case that smoking was good for you, even though they really tried.
Well, no, but you know? You could also choose not to drive a car and never use gas and ride a bike. I mean, you don't have to do something like that.
Yeah, but as long as other people were using gasoline cars, it's the tragedy of the commons, Jeff. Right? You know, it still went into the same air that everybody else was breathing. But yeah, that's why. But I'm just saying though that when you see them saying that a specific generation tends to be affected by it, I think that is going to be angling for future lawsuits. Would you agree with me or not on that? That's why they're, you know, trying to say it's not your fault. It's not because of the destruction of the family or various other communistic programs coming in the 1970s. It's only the lead that's causing you the problems. Would you figure that's what they're going to do with that, though?
Well, you know, when you have lawyers involved, they'll sue everybody for just breathing air because you're using too much oxygen or something. So.
Jeff, I appreciate the call. Thanks for checking in. All right. And by the way, here it is, Conspiracy Theory Thursday. So there it is. If you're Generation X and you're depressed, sue the oil companies. I don't know. Hello, Dave. How are you doing this morning? What's going on?
I'm doing really good.
Good.
I wanted to say, I think it's been about 50 years that they removed the lead from paint and gasoline and a lot of things.
Okay. Well, it was 1996 for the removal of that was the final. Total, like, you were never able to have any leaded gasoline around anymore. That's when they got rid of that. Now, leaded paint was back in the 1970s, or I want to say early 70s. That was a big deal. That was real, by the way. It was a big problem.
Yeah. But what I'm getting at is down here in Southern Oregon, the only place you could buy it in 1996 was in racing fuel. It was long gone, probably from the early 80s, because everything went to unleaded gas.
Yeah, it was the late 1970s that they went to unleaded gas in cars. But you're right, the only leaded fuel was used in racing. And I also think, and I don't know if they're still doing it or not, aviation fuel probably, right?
Aviation fuel has to have it because of the design of the engines and the power lift capacity to get a plane off the ground. So the only place they use it now is an aviation gas, and as far as I know, they still use it in racing cars.
Yeah, now, so, when we say aviation gas, we're talking about gasoline, not the jet fuel. Jet fuel doesn't have tetraethyl lead. So
I'm not talking about jet fuel. I'm talking about for your regular, small planes.
Yeah, but you got to understand, this is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, so if you're going to talk about jet fuel, then you have to talk about the chemicals that are put into it for chemtrails, okay?
There's no chemicals because that would blow up a jet engine.
Yes.
If they're spraying.
No. You don't understand that. You know how many people you upset when you say that, though?
Well,
you're telling the truth. You're telling the truth, but that doesn't fit the narrative, okay?
No. Chemtrails are just to lead you down a rabbit hole because it's something you can never prove one way or the other.
All right. But now we've said it, so the floodgates will open. But anyway, thank you for the call, Dave. Let me go to the next line. Hi, good morning. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Who's this? Hello?
Hello, this is Linda Marie. My Royal Highness.
Hello, Linda Marie, Royal Highness. Now, you're obviously depressed. I think you're Generation X, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you're Generation X. Are you ready to then sue the oil company for your depression?
No, okay. In fact, there was a bigger problem. You're right with lead paint, and there were kids eating lead paint.
Yes, did you ever eat lead paint even accidentally as a kid? Good. All right, that was a real thing, and a lot of people wonder, well, why did kids eat lead paint? And it's because lead tastes sweet to people. In fact, I don't know if you realize this, but I was reading about the use of lead, and of course they think lead to a lot of the no pun intended led to the downfall of the Roman Empire. In many cases, they used lead in their pipes. They used lead to sweeten things, to sweeten food sometimes. So yikes! Needless to say, good to get rid of it. Okay.
The other thing is, it's an anti-car thing again. They're pushing us to buy electric cars. And the other thing is we didn't use as much lead gasoline as in international cities like Mexico City. Holy cow. You saw pictures of that.
Oh,
smog was thicker there than in Los Angeles or New York or any of our cities.
That's right. You've traveled quite a bit over the years, from what I recall. Yeah. Mexico City still a pollution pit here, but you know, they're making it sound, though, I just find it interesting, they're trying to lay the problems of Gen X on tetraethyl lead. And I think I would want to be very careful about that judgment. I think there are many things that may have some effect, because tetraethyl lead in the air, tetraethyl lead is poisonous. It is. And they put it in the gasoline supplies because it raised octane and nobody really thought much about it. But people who lived in the inner cities where there was more of an air pollution problem did have more of an issue with the lead blood levels, along with the blood levels caused by leaded paint. So there we go. Appreciate the call there, Linda Marie. Have a good day, Your Highness. 6:31. All right. We're going to shift the gears. We're going to talk a little finance on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Next, it's going to be Todd Sheets, and he's written a book, 2008, What Really Happened, Understanding the Great Financial Crisis, and why it's important that we know about this, because it's looking a little sketchy right now, I think. We'll talk with Todd about that coming up.
As a business owner, you likely do a lot of driving around town, so turn your business vehicle into an attention-getting rolling billboard. The Wash Buggy Wrap Lab brands and restyles cars, pickups, vans, even big rigs with durable vinyl to present your business logo and info in a professional, contemporary design that's guaranteed to make a bold statement. The Wash Buggy Wrap Lab is your source for paint protection film, window tint, and vinyl wrap for your personal vehicle, too. Get your design suggestion today. Visit washbuggyautospa.com.
This holiday season, Stephen Westfall Roofing, Inc. wants to extend a heartfelt thank you to all of their amazing customers. Your trust and support have made this year truly special. As everyone celebrates this joyous time, they want to wish you happy holidays and a happy new year filled with warmth, happiness, and prosperity. From the Westfall team to your home, thank you for choosing Stephen Westfall Roofing, Inc. Visit them at StephenWestfallRoofingInc.com for all your roofing solutions.
Latest news brought to you by local
Montana Roofing Services.com.
News Talk 106.3 KMED. This is the Bill Meyer Show.
About 16 years since we were reporting ceaselessly or incessantly, I think is the better term, about the financial crisis. What are we going to do? Real estate is crawling, and people are just losing their shirts. And right up to that, people were told, Bill, just buy a house, buy any house. You can't lose until you lose, right? And I have odd feelings, kind of a little bit of deja vu going through my head. I wanted to talk with Todd Sheets. Todd Sheets has written a book about what actually happened back in 2008. He's done a whole lot of original research on this. And he graduated with honors from University of Iowa, had a long career in investment banking. He also led the Raymond James Financial Recovering Markets Program. They bought undervalued apartment properties in distressed markets. And so he's done well, and they were sold well for the investors. But he thinks it's important that we know what actually happened then. It's his new book, 2008, What Really Happened. Todd, great to have you on. Good morning, sir.
Bill, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, what's interesting about looking back at the financial crisis is that most of us lived through this, and so we remember it's recent history. And I knew we were going into trouble even in 2006, 2007. I had friends of mine that, you know, like cocktail napkins would tell me things like, buy a house, you can't lose. We had all of our TV weather people were retiring and becoming real estate speculators. I mean, it just went nuts, you know, at that time. You remember all that, right? Everything like that.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the old thing about the stock market crash in 1929 was when all the cab drivers were making so much money in stocks, they were retiring that kind of thing. That was about what it was like in housing at that time. You're right.
Yeah, and a lot of people got hosed. And of course, I know this is probably not part of your book, but one of the concerns that I have is that, you know, the Federal Reserve blew a bubble in housing and now seems to have re-blown a bubble in housing and also added a bubble in stocks and other financial assets. Am I wrong about that, to even think about how it's happened since 08? What do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I go through in the book is that starting, especially in 1987, we went through this extended period where the Federal Reserve, sometimes with assist from the Treasury, stepped in to try and bail the markets out from a series of events, many of which were unprecedented. And so the 87, there was a stock market crash towards the end of the Reagan administration. Alan Greenspan had just been appointed president. He lowered interest rates famously. The market turned around fairly quickly. He was hailed as, you know, for making this quick move to kind of bail the markets out. It turned out there weren't really any huge systemic problems underneath, which is why the, you know, the market, you know, continued upward through the 90s and, you know, had a great run there. But then we got into the 90s and there was this series of, you know, effectively market bailouts. There was the Mexican debt crisis in 1995, the Asian debt crisis in 1997.
Wasn't there a ruble crisis, too, at some point? It seemed Russia had a problem?
Yeah, that's what I was going to lead up to next. And then you had the ruble collapse, which led to the collapse of a giant hedge fund named Long Term Capital Management, which the Federal Reserve stepped in and kind of performed a stealth bailout of that institution, where it effectively, you know, convinced a number of Wall Street players to step in and backstop the institution, and then in return lowered interest rates dramatically to support their business and the value of the assets that they were backstopping. And that lowering of interest rates in 1998 actually mirrors very closely what the Fed did in the 20s that led to the 29 crash. But in 1998, it played a meaningful role in the massive kind of last phase expansion of the tech stock bubble that I'm sure you probably remember.
The dot-com deal.
And I'll try and wrap this up quickly, but then that exploded in 2000. The Fed then stepped in late 2000, early 2001, with a historic lowering of interest rates to try and bail the system out from the consequences of the tech stock bubble. And then that was kind of, as I point out in the book, that was the second key development that really pushed the housing bubble to unprecedented heights.
So what happened in 2008, you're saying, Todd, then, really had its origins going back 10, 15, 20 years prior, what was going on.
Absolutely. Right? In part it did, because we had this run of bailouts and we had this expectation in the marketplace that gets built up that, you know, it was got used to, there was a phrase for it called the Greenspan put.
Yeah.
Which was that anytime things got into trouble, you could expect the Fed to kind of, you know, ride into the rescue with the cavalry. And, you know, all guns flaring.
Boy, talk about a moral hazard if you know that, you know, heads I win, tails they lose. You know, you're going to keep doing what you're doing, right? That's what happens.
Exactly. And so then to get to the point that you started us off with, so then the housing bubble collapses. You know, I, at that point, I wasn't as much of a student of all of this as I became afterward when I was starting to try and figure out, well, what happened with all these things and how did this system that, you know, had operated in a certain way with kind of at least the expectation of a reasonably or less limited role for government and the Federal Reserve and that kind of thing in the markets, the economy, all these different things. All of a sudden, that kind of got blown up. I thought we were going to go into a very, very significant economic downturn at that point in time, and we did to some extent, but not as deeply as I had thought we might be headed for. And the big reason was, to my surprise, the Fed basically doubled down again afterward and again drove interest rates to historic lows and went even further with this program of what is kind of euphemistically called quantitative easing, which basically means they buy long-term debt. You know, prior to that point in time, their main tool of manipulation was short-term interest rates. But then they went into this quantitative easing program where they were also trying to manipulate long-term interest rates, built up a huge inventory or balance sheet of long-term securities, mostly government securities and otherwise. And this lasted, you know, throughout much of the period after the crisis.
That was also what I termed a financial repression, in my opinion, because if you were a saver, you got hosed, didn't you, Todd, in all this time with low interest rates?
Yes, and actually that was one of the things that, you know, when I also talk about in the book, when you go back to the early 2000s, the Fed's policies did two things. One is the housing bubble had already been triggered by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac starting in 1998, which I point out that was clearly the beginning of the bubble and the beginning of the takeoff of housing prices. The Fed made this historic mistake of lowering interest rates to below the level of housing appreciation, which was close to an unprecedented event and created an enormous opportunity for exactly what you described at the introduction, which was this potential for quick profits in the housing market because it magnified the impacts of leverage so much. Whenever interest rates are lower than the rate of appreciation on the asset you're financing, you know, it significantly leverages up the return opportunity. So all that created, on one hand, an enormous demand for short-term variable rate loans to buy homes with, so you could magnify the returns on investment. At the same time, as you're pointing out, it created enormous demand for on the part of savers who wanted to try and get something with yield. And the two of these things helped feed each other because these yield-hungry or yield-starved investors were looking for then these mortgage securities that were being created that gave some higher level of return than the other more conventional and safer investments that people were used to investing in and holding.
Now, when you talk about those mortgage-backed securities, and people may have forgotten about that, essentially that was when you would take a bunch of mortgages, a lot of them you might not even think are all that good, but you figure that you make financial sausage out of it, you grind it all up, put it together. And I know I'm kind of, you know, explaining it, you know, with a broad brush there. But essentially that, you know, you hide the bad mortgages in the sausage, but you figure that there are enough good ones that everything would be okay. Is that kind of the simple way of looking at these securities?
That was part of it. I mean, you know, in essence, the mortgage securitization thing always sounded like such an obscure, you know, kind of arcane Wall Street product. But in essence, it was, you know, no more complicated than the idea of, you know, having a company's assets in a corporation whose stock is traded on the exchange. And like you just described, they put a bunch of mortgages in a pool, which created some diversification benefits. You could mix in some lower rated, higher return securities to try and juice the yields up. And then they sold off interest in those securitization pools to investors. And those were very popular on the investor side, because people were doing exactly what you just said. They were yield starved.
Well, you couldn't put money in the bank. You know, money in the bank was 0.5%. You were losing big time, right?
Exactly.
Everybody was turned into a speculator, I think, is what we're getting to, Todd. Isn't that true, really? What happened?
There's no question that these misguided policies led many people down a path of, one, buying homes and speculating on quick returns. And other people, some knowingly, some not. You know, some big institutional investors were doing the same thing, but searching for yield in the marketplace. And in order to get it, they were being forced to take on more speculative investing activities than they otherwise would have needed to if we had been in a more normal interest rate environment and that kind of thing. So then coming back quickly, you know, to the point that, you know, you asked about, which is where are we today? So we had the Fed responding to the collapse of the bubble with these unprecedented new interventions, including the interest rate, roughly a decade of low interest rates, and then this quantitative easing program, which was designed to lower long-term interest rates. And if you look at where we are today, housing prices are back up to historic highs. I don't think we have the same risk of an immediate collapse as we had last time, because lending standards have changed and lenders have learned from the last one. But what we have now is an affordability crisis that you're reading about, where nobody can afford to buy a home.
I would dare say that in some cases the markets are kind of frozen, because I'm looking at my $53,000 crap shack in Medford when I moved here in 1993, or that I bought in 1993, is now considered a $300,000 starter home. 300 grand, Todd. You know, it's like,
it's like you shake your head about it, and like, you know, and we think, what's a young, hardworking couple, family, or whatever, you know, just coming out of college, what are they going to do? How can they afford housing? And I think that's part of the frustrations that we saw come through in the recent election with many younger people moving and voting for Trump, because they're so frustrated with not just, I think this has been missed in a lot of the discussion. You know, everybody's talked about consumer price inflation, but we haven't had enough, of a discussion about asset inflation, which we see in housing, like we're talking about. We see the same things in the stock market. You know, there's a measure called the 10-year cyclically adjusted PE ratio, which, you know, sounds like a, you know, big ball.
I think most people I hope most people listening understand price earnings ratio.
Yeah.
You give a dollar to a company, how much do they pay you for that dollar each year, right? Essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
And this is the same guy that prepares the housing indexes that I worked with in analyzing the bubble in the book. Robert Shiller at Yale has it's a 10-year average earnings adjusted for cyclicality to take out a lot of those things, so that you get a more consistent, smoother measure. The normal average PE multiple for that is right around 16 to 17, and today we're up in the mid 30s, which is close to historic highs. And so, you know, again, these are the things, the asset inflation that have been created. And you could say the same thing in the bond market to some extent. You know, we have these very low interest rates, which have pushed bond prices. Some of that has been mitigated over the last couple of years when the Fed had to finally move interest rates up to more normalized levels.
So even when people are looking at 4 or 5% interest rates, though, that's not high with historical standards, right?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, of course, you know, we remember periods that were much higher than that going back into the 80s and that kind of thing. But even under more normalized standards, you know, you get long-term government bonds down in the 4.5%. Those are pretty low rates. I mean, you know, we're typically would be looking at something you know, 5% or above in an environment where you're looking to have, you know, 2.5 to 3% kind of inflation, probably more like 5.5% long-term interest rates. So we are still very much in an environment of financial manipulation with consequences that haven't fully played out in all likelihood. You know, it's never 100% certainty as to how these kind of things are going to go, but you can see by these objective standards that, you know, it's a potentially dangerous environment.
Yeah, I've been looking at this. By the way, Todd Sheets is on the program right now, and he's written an excellent book. It's called 2008, What Really Happened. He did all this original research on his own here, you know, given that he's been in the financial world for a long time. You know, what happened and where it happens, and have we learned any lessons from this? Because when I look at everything right now, is it unfair to call the current financial system in the United States and around the world, really, the everything bubble, everything being in a bubble now?
Well, everything is certainly very high. And so, you know, I think it could be a bubble, likely. It might not necessarily pop and explode or implode in the same way as the last time. I mean, that is one possibility that could occur. Another one is, which is, you know, also dangerous in a, you know, less obvious kind of way, is that people just don't get the returns on investment. You know, we could see values stagnate for an incredibly long period of time, like happened in Japan, you know, after the Japanese stock bubbles back in the 1980s. And then those popped and they put all this financial stimulus into the system and the stock market just went nowhere for decades.
Oh, it was like don't they call it like the lost decades that they had there? And it's like pushing a string, right? Doesn't matter how low you made the interest rate. Nobody would lend and nobody wanted to borrow, you know, really, in essence, right? That kind of thing.
Exactly. Now, fortunately, in this country, you know, we still have a very dynamic underlying economic system. We have some of the greatest countries in the world, and we're going through a major period of technological advancement. And hopefully some of those things, you know, can and will help us through this, which I'm sure they will. But yes, we have created another era of extremely high asset values, potentially bubble-like. And, you know, there's a possibility that, you know, we haven't seen the end of this long cycle that, you know, we were just talking about dating all the way back to the 1980s.
Yeah, I'm looking at what's been going on with the stock market and talking with one of my stock guys, Matt, who is was telling me about how everybody, I think he thinks that the relief right now, they're calling it the Trump relief rally. Would that be a good way of looking at it, in which they know, OK, we're not going full communist in 2025, you know, yet?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, or at least, you know, so far into socialism that we end up like Europe and you know, we don't have an ability to grow our way out of it. To me, I think that's part of what's being reflected here is this hope that, you know, if we make some dramatic changes to the way things have gone for the last 4 years, that we can give ourselves an opportunity to try and grow our way out of some of these problems that, you know, have been created over the last couple of decades by these policies.
What do you think about the health of the banking system overall here, Todd? And I bring this up because I was reading an interesting story that gave me chills that that there are effectively some of our biggest banks in the United States of America, the ones that are considered too big to fail, are underwater. Because they ended up buying government bonds at a 0.5% or 1% back when the yields were really low, and they put tons of money. Bank of America comes to mind as an example of that. J.P. Morgan Chase also got a lot of these things. So they're huge. They're everyday names, and yet if they had to sell those bonds, they're done. Lots of losses. What do you think about that?
Well, there's an old Warren Buffett line, I don't know if you've heard it or not, that you don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a case, we saw a little bit of this a year and a half ago with a couple of smaller banking failures when the Fed had to push up interest rates because inflation ran up. And it caught a couple of smaller banks with exactly this issue. And there is an issue at the banks. And there's potentially an issue at the Federal Reserve with this also.
Really?
Because the Federal Reserve has effectively, through this quantitative easing program, taken on this enormous portfolio of longer-term securities to try and push interest rates down, and they're effectively financing it with short-term borrowing. You know, given the way the Fed works. And
okay.
So,
now, that's kind of weird. It's kind of like the worst thing to do is like paying off your mortgage with credit cards, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's the old, you know, the old thing about, you know, lending long and borrowing short kind of thing that, you know, destroyed the savings and loan industry back in the 80s. Well, really started to be destroyed in the 70s with the inflation at that time. So, yeah, we've got this, you know, a dangerous environment. There's probably a lot of exposure in the system in many places, not just the banks and at the Fed. But if, and it's all predicated on, well, what does it mean for the tide to go out? For the tide to go out would mean that we get inflation moving up to more like what we would normally have in low interest rate environments. And I think we've been protected from the consequences of that, one, by globalization and all the impact of lowering costs by moving manufacturing offshore that's happened, and second, by these extraordinary advances that have been happening with, you know, technology, with the technology boom and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, but if those things, you know, don't continue and we get back into a higher inflationary period and the Fed has to push interest rates up, that is the tide going out, and then we'll find out exactly, you know, who is exposed and how severely they are.
Would it be fair to say that President Trump's trade plan, which is essentially a trade war with China and various other things, there's been a big push everywhere to almost deglobalize. And you're right. You know, it lowered a lot of costs because we're buying everything, you know, from China or whatever it is with lower labor rates, et cetera, in other countries. But if we're going to end up going into trade wars and trying to rebuild our own manufacturing and also putting up tariffs on China and Mexico and various other places, that could be a trigger for the tide going out in some ways for the banking, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be that way?
I mean, that could be a possible, you know, trigger, like you said. I mean, that's one thing I think many people are warning about right now and are somewhat concerned about, and we'll just have to see how they play out. I mean, hopefully, you know, he'll manage these issues and make decisions at the right levels in the right way. And some of what's being talked about may be bluster to try and change other policies.
Yeah, it's a negotiating tactic. Yeah, I get that. You know, that, and he does that a lot, though. And so you always have to take things with a grain of salt when you hear President Trump say, "Yeah, I'm going to do this." It's like, okay, what does he really want? You know,
Exactly. He's setting up the next conversation in many of those situations. But
yeah. I'm going to make you the 51st state. I love that, by the way, when he was talking with Trudeau the other day. Well, so, why do you think ultimately here, and by the way, Todd Sheets with me here, why do you think it is so important that we understand what happened then? Is it because we're close to another one, or is it a way to maybe, you know, change some policies for the future? Because I'm not convinced we completely learned our lesson yet. I got a really strange spidey sense of what is going on in the world these days.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've hit on the key points there. I mean, one, we have to understand what happened in order to develop the right policies. And just, I should just mention, in about 5 minutes or so, I'm going to have to drop off. I've got a meeting that I've got to head out to. Mm-hmm. But we have to understand what really happened to protect ourselves, to protect our institutions and the system from another occurrence, and so that we can implement the correct policies. And, you know, I think the primary sense of what happened that evolved out of these circumstances was that the crisis was caused by what I call the gradual deregulation theory in the book, which was that, you know, we started this trend of deregulation in the late Carter and then in the Reagan years. It got pushed too far. It eventually allowed things, the private markets, to spin out of control because there wasn't enough regulatory and government oversight, and it all blew up. And then we learned our lesson and we imposed all these new regulations, so on and so forth. Well, what I show in the book is that is clearly not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was a housing bubble took off beginning in 1998, and the data shows very clearly that that's when it started. That is exactly the point in 1998, when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac decided to embark on a major expansion of their role in the housing markets, their growth rates more than doubled from 1997 to 1998 and stayed that way for the next 4 years. And that drove the initial phase of the bubble. And then, as we've talked about, the Fed dropped interest rates to below the rate of housing appreciation, which then triggered the next phase of the bubble, which I call the acceleration phase. The bubble was then popped when the Fed had to normalize interest rates. And I don't think we have conclusively demonstrated that that was the cause, nor have we created new policies that take into consideration that those were the actual causes. So, you know, what are the cures then if those are the causes, which I'm convinced they are, and I think the evidence is, close to irrefutable in the book. Well, then you have to remove the GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, from their role in the housing markets. They've become so large, and you can't have these government-privileged entities with their special borrowing privileges with the ability to affect housing prices so much. And we have to do something about the Fed's ability to do what we started off talking about, which is to blow asset bubbles. And, they operate with a dual mandate, to protect against high inflation and high unemployment. But at some point, we either need to find a way to dramatically curtail or hold the Fed responsible for doing what we started off talking about, which was also the ability to create asset bubbles.
Yeah,
because those are very dangerous in and of themselves. You know, that's another form of stealth inflation that can be extremely harmful for the people who get sucked into these different kinds of seemingly can't lose kind of situations that we've talked about.
Yep. You can't lose until you do. 2008.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. 2008. What really happened? Todd Sheets is the author. I'll put all your information up, and I know you got to get to your meeting. Thanks for having taken some time to talk about it this morning. Very important book, Todd. Thank you very much. Be well.
Bill, thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Me too. Great talk. It is 3 after 7. This is KMED, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KPXG Grants Pass. American Rancher Garage,
United in Service. Hi.